Welcome. Today is the 5th of October, 2010. And let's briefly go over the monthly planner, just to say a couple of highlights for the month of October. We had a few silver days. They are behind us now. And we're going to go into a very long stretch of gray starting tomorrow. For those of you who are listening to this on the internet, because several people do, you can find this planetary planner on the home page of the website. Down on the right, it says Monthly Planetary Planner. Open that up, find your time zone, or calculate if your time zone isn't there. Add or subtract an hour or whatever it might be. There's five different time zones there. Ireland, UK is there. Europe, Western Europe, which is different. China, Singapore, Perth, Australia is there. And New York time zone, Eastern time in the US, and Pacific time, Los Angeles time zone. Those are the five. You can calculate anything from those. So that's where you find them if you're listening to this on the internet. We are referring to the, because we're in Ireland and close to the UK, that's the one we're referring to here. So we have a lot of gray from Wednesday the 6th until Friday the 15th. Gray days are not the best days for important work. If you want to start something new that's very important to you, you're trying to launch a new business or whatever you're trying to begin that must succeed, these are not good days, beginning days, because they are problematic. Does it mean it absolutely won't succeed? No. It may well succeed. But you want to remove as much of the difficulty as possible. This is just kind of a ready reckoner and to help you to avoid problems. This is not done for your chart, these calculations. It is just done for where the planets are in the sky for everybody. So gray days, best to be avoided. We have some gold days coming up from the 20th. Depending what part of the world you're in, from the 20th to the 22nd of October. Those are ideal days. Once again, you're going to see Jupiter in the sky with the moon, which is worth seeing at nighttime. And they'll be right close together, the two of them. That's Jupiter is in Pisces. And then you'll have some silver days coming up on the 25th to the 27th, almost as good as gold days. Moon will be exalted in Taurus. So excellent, excellent time. Moon in Taurus, moon is the mind. So these are all calculated with the moon, moon's position in mind. Because how the moon goes, so the psyche of the people goes. So you want a good mental outlook about things. We were kindly invited to a wedding last Wednesday. A cousin of Kalindi's got married. They never consulted us about days or times or anything like that, which is fine. But they chose Silver Day. And it was exalted moon in Taurus. And we went to the wedding at the zoo. They had it at the zoo. And at the zoo, you can rent a special sort of room in this special building. It does have bars, but not on that building. And they had their wedding there amidst the roars of tigers. And shenanigans of monkeys, you could hear them. And then we went to a dinner at the Dandelion. It was a very, very nice day. Everybody had a wonderful time because the moon was exalted in Taurus. So a lot of love, very open-hearted, good fun, positive. Everybody had a great time.
It's amazing. I was at the zoo the previous Sunday. I was thinking to myself, we're going to get married here. Absolutely amazing. But it was a fun day. God,
yeah,
brilliant.
Yeah, and it the sun shone that day for them, so which is also good. So then we have a few more silver days right at the end of the month, from the 29th to the 31st. More silver days. So there's a lot of nice things available this month. So I encourage you to take advantage of that information. Not so much day-to-day stuff, but if you have something important to do. And the Mercury in the sky has just entered Virgo as of September 30th. Come on in. Welcome. How are you, Dave? Good. Have a seat. So Mercury has entered Virgo on September 30th until not very long, October 17th, only for 2 weeks. And Mercury is exalted in Virgo. Mercury is the planet of communication. Sales, marketing, study, networking, business organization, media, multimedia, writing, broadcasting, internet, it's all Mercury. So it's not very long. It's only for a couple of weeks, but it's right now until the 17th. So if any of you are in such fields, you can take advantage of that. Excellent time to launch a sales campaign, marketing campaign, for example. Or right now, September 30th until October 17th. It's only 2 weeks, but a real good time to do it. Exalted Mercury, it just things will flow far more easily in this period. If you're writing, if you're recording, excellent period. Then on October 17th, Mercury moves into Libra and the Sun moves into Libra, both the same day. So the Sun will be in Libra for a month.
October 17th
till November 16th. The Sun in Libra is about legal matters, justice, fairness, equanimity. It's an excellent time for arbitration, negotiation, conciliation, peacemaking, trying to arrive at an agreement with somebody. It's in the sign of Venus, so anything Venusian, like relationships, it enhances that. Or art, or beauty, enjoyment. But the Sun is also debilitated in Libra. That's its weakest sign out of 12. That's theoretically the weakest month of the year for the Sun. So not always the best time to approach an authority figure. If you are a person who suffers from lack of confidence, insecurity, inadequacy, insufficiency, not feeling good enough, not feeling worthy, not feeling deserving. These are all symptoms of a weak son position in a birth chart. So that might not be the best month for you. And this is the kind of thing we can see when sun is in Libra. People like that will then sometimes overcompensate. If you can't get positive attention, you'll seek whatever attention you can get. Sometimes that's negative attention. So those are some symptoms of sun in Libra. But creatively, artistically, excellent month. October 19th, Mars enters Scorpio. Until November 30th, Mars rules Scorpio. It's in its own sign. If you have anything to do with physical culture, working out, going to the gym, training others, anything along those lines, Mars is especially strong. Of course, in Scorpio, in its own sign. It's also a good time to discover hidden things. Things that you're not aware of, or that people are hiding from you, or keeping secret. This is the time they will come out. Or the time that you can see into and through people and circumstances. So, it's discovery. It's also an excellent time for innovation, invention, thinking outside the box. Scorpio, it's very good for that. The downside of Scorpio is being offering destructive criticism instead of constructive criticism. The other downside of Scorpio is being manipulative. People with a lot of Scorpio influence may tend to be more manipulative. So that's the downside. But there's a lot of with planets and birth charts and planetary influences. It's not good. It's not bad. It depends in whose hands you find it, in whose life you find it. How evolved is the person? The first thing you have to determine is how evolved is the person. Because an evolved person will take Mars and work in a very proactive manner, which means they'll set goals, they'll work toward those goals, they'll fulfill those goals. Whereas a less evolved person will be more reactive in manner. And they'll point the finger at others and say, yeah, I was going to do it, but then this happened, this person did this, and this person said that. And they'll disempower themselves, or they'll claim that others are disempowering them. So these are all Scorpio influences. Depends on the person. So you can vibrate according to the more evolved influence or less evolved influence. Up to you. So the more evolved you become, you can take any negative and turn it into a positive. Or, at the very least, you can neutralize it, which means even though it's a negative, it doesn't affect you. Which, of course, isn't always easy to do. But ideally, that's a very high state of spirituality. Being unaffected. No matter what happens. With the good stuff, too. Take it all in stride. On the 16th of October, Saturday, I believe. It is the appearance day of Ram, Sri Ram. According to the Vedic calendar, yoga calendar, Ram is an incarnation of Vishnu. Vishnu is God. Incarnation of Krishna. Krishna is God. Vishnu is God in four-arm form. And Krishna is God in two-arm form. It's God. Different God than the one you know? No, same. God is unlimited. God can take as many forms as he likes, according to varying conceptions. So Ram appeared on the earth in the Treta Yuga. So that's a few million years ago, or a couple million years ago. And Ram was the incarnation of Dharma. He was a king. He was born in a royal family. He was a prince. And when he finally made it to the throne, which took a while, he governed the people righteously, according to Dharma, according to virtue and morality, righteousness, kindness, protection. He was highly, highly trained and skilled in politics, in kingship, and statecraft. In a democratic society, you do not have that luxury. Because whoever runs for office, you have a choice. You can vote for them or not vote for them. 99% of them have no training in the job that they're running for. All they are, they're party members. They work for and with the party. If the party gets elected because of their loyalty and their work, they get, and how high they are up in the pecking order, they get a favor from the party, and they will be given a ministerial post, perhaps a portfolio, and they'll be Minister of Agriculture. Never been on a farm, but I'm the Minister of Agriculture. Or you'll be the Minister of the Gaeltacht. Can't speak Irish, but I'm the Minister of the Gaeltacht.
Minister for Finance.
Not an economist. So you get the picture. So that's what you get nowadays in our society. Not just here in Ireland, but pretty much around the world. And the other option is a dictator.
Except Sweden. Sweden, you have to be qualified.
Oh, well, see, now I didn't know that. So Sweden, you have to be qualified.
You have to have some background or else you don't get ministries. I heard that recently. I thought, oh, that's interesting.
Well, that is excellent.
Thank
you. Okay, so let's talk immigration. You know, it is kind of funny, though. If you go to apply for a job in the private sector, the first thing they say to you is what? What's your qualification? Even in the public sector, did you study? And did you work in the field?
I worked nearly in the public sector.
You know, tell me what qualifies you. Politics? Not so important. Well, according to the Vedic understanding, politics is defined as the signs of friends and enemies, or friendships and enmities. Anyway, October 16th is Ram's appearance day. If you're interested, it's a good day for fasting, to increase your meditation. It's a Saturday. To increase your chanting of mantras. To read spiritual literature. To commune with God. very, very auspicious day to give something up. You know, take a day off meat if you eat meat. Be good. All right. Any questions about any of that?
I missed that on the old Gray Days. Start of 7th of...
Tomorrow, yeah.
Yeah.
The day after.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're
what's that?
I said if you're involved, you won't have it affect you.
Right, you'll be, you'll be transcendental. Okay. So, we're going to talk a little bit about Dharma. I've been reading this excellent book called Jiva Dharma. And Jiva comes from the root word Jiva. What's Jiva? Soul. Jiva is the soul. So the Dharma of a soul. So I just. Yeah. So Atma. Jiva is another name for Atma. Mm-hmm.
But also for living things as well.
Mm-hmm.
Jivan.
Mm-hmm.
Jivan is just like.
Yeah, a Jivan. It's a living being. I'll just read this little excerpt that I, and I'll have to, some of the stuff will might be over your head, but only there's a lot of Sanskrit terms. So I'll help you with that. So Sannyasi Thakur said, Prabhu, for a long time I've heard of the preeminence of Dharma, the importance of preeminence of Dharma. On numerous occasions I've asked the question, what is Dharma to so many people? It is a cause of distress to me that the answers those people have given contradict each other. So please tell me, what is the true constitutional dharma of the jivas? The jivas are living beings. We're jivas. We're all jivas. What is the true constitutional dharma of the jivas? And why do different teachers explain the nature of Dharma in such diverse ways? If Dharma is one, why don't all learned teachers cultivate that one universal Dharma, which is one without a second? So, before I continue, what is Dharma? Give me some meanings for Dharma.
Life duty.
Life duty.
Righteousness.
Righteousness.
Life teaching.
No. Teachings, it's religion. Okay. Religion is Dharma, which is a set of teachings or a way of conduct. A way of life, a way of conduct, in that sense, is Dharma. It could be religion, but it could be what you do religiously. You know. It's duty, it's obligation. It's also essence or nature, fundamental nature of a thing. The dharma of sugar is sweetness. Can you separate these two things, sugar and sweetness? No. So, those are some meanings for dharma. There's no word in English that explains dharma. It means all of these things. It means spirituality.
Spiritual duties.
Spiritual duties. Morality. Dharma means if you, for example, are married and you have a job and every day you go to your job and you work and you get paid and you bring the money home and you pay your mortgage or pay your rent, you buy food, you feed your loved ones, and you do this day in and day out, that's dharma. That's dharma also. Because it's a duty, an obligation, and you're fulfilling it. Paramahansa Babaji meditated on the lotus feet of Bhagavan Sri Krishna Chaitanya. He meditated on God and began to speak. He said, "O most fortunate one, I shall describe to you the principles of Dharma as far as my knowledge allows. An object is called a vastu." And we know this word, don't we? Vastu. From vastu we get vastu. Vastu, vastu. Which means the science of placing objects. Right? The spatial relationships. But a thing is a vastu.
So, object.
Object. An object. So that's, he says, an object is called a vastu. And its eternal nature is known as Nitya Dharma. Nitya means eternal. So eternal nature. You may have a Dharma in this lifetime. You may have a duty, an obligation, a belief, a religion in this lifetime. Is that your eternal Dharma?
No.
Lifetime after lifetime? Likely not. So there, what he's trying to get at is the eternal Dharma. Nature arises from the elementary structure of an object. By Krishna's desire, by God's desire, when an object is formed, a particular nature is inherent in that structure as an eternal concomitant factor. So an object has a nature. Here's an object. It's hard. This is a harmonium. It plays music. It has a bellows. It has a keyboard. So it has a nature. Or we could just take wood. Wood has a nature. It's hard. It has, what do you call these things? Grain. So many things, so. The nature is the Nitya Dharma of the object. So we know wood instantly. If somebody says this is wood, you'd know instantly if it's wood, if it's not wood. The nature of a given object becomes altered or distorted when a change takes place within it, either by force of circumstance or due to contact with other objects. With the passage of time, distorted nature becomes fixed and appears to be permanent, as if it were the eternal nature of that object. This distorted nature is not the true nature of the object. It is the nisarga, the nature which is acquired through long-term association. This nisarga occupies the place of the factual nature and becomes identified as its svabhava, its true nature. So it's kind of hard to wrap your mind around. So what's he saying is this. The soul, the jiva, has an eternal nature. But he becomes covered over by a material body. And having carrying or having a material body and doing that for a long time, we begin to believe that that is our real nature, our true nature. We become fully identified with this material body, which is made of earth, water, fire, air, and ether as our true nature. But it isn't. How do we know it isn't? Because it comes into being, it has birth, it grows, it goes through various changes, it sometimes produces offspring, it dwindles, it gets old, worn out, and it dies off. So that cannot be our eternal nature or our true nature, because it's temporary and it has limits. So, and we're also subject to birth, old age, suffering, disease, and death. None of these is the true or eternal nature of the jiva, of the soul.
We also have love, fun, faith.
Yeah, those are more the nature. Well, I'm just proving that this, the body is not the eternal nature. So, for example, water is an object and its swabhava is liquidity. So the nature of water is liquidity. When water solidifies due to certain circumstances and becomes ice, the acquired nature of solidity takes the place of its inherent nature. So the real nature of water seems to disappear. When a human being, when a living being takes on a body, the real nature of the soul, the spiritual nature, disappears. It's there, but it's covered over by the body. So we begin to think that the body is the reality, and we lose all touch, we lose track, we lose remembrance of the soul within the body. So we begin to think that we are that body. In reality, this acquired nature is not eternal. Rather, it is occasional or temporary. It arises because of some cause. And when that cause is no longer effective, this acquired nature vanishes automatically. However, the true nature, the svabhava, is eternal. One's real nature is eternal. It may become distorted, but it still remains inseparably connected to its object. And the original nature will certainly become evident again when the proper time and circumstances arise. So, what is our eternal nature? Our temporal nature in the body could be various things, whatever you do, your dharma. What's our eternal dharma?
Well,
love. Yeah. That's our eternal dharma. Love with whom? Love with God. So everybody down here on this plane is looking for love. And love, whatever love you may find here, not that you cannot find love, but it's temporal, it's temporary because it comes to an end. And it results in loss, ultimately. Whatever you love or whoever you love, it's taken away at some point in time. And that causes pain. We don't want the love to end, especially if you can find a real loving relationship. You want it to continue. But even if the two people continue to love each other, once death comes, it separates them. So the eternal nature is love for God, for your source. That which put you here. So to reawaken that love is to reawaken your eternal nature and to enter into it. It doesn't end when death comes. And it can go on and on, lifetime after lifetime. Ultimately, you want to get off the wheel of samsara, repeated birth and death, and go and live in the spiritual realm. Okay. The svabhava of an object is its eternal nature. Well, its acquired nature is its occasional function. Those who have true knowledge can know the difference between eternal and occasional function. Whereas those who lack this knowledge consider acquired nature to be true nature. So the acquired nature is the body you've acquired in this lifetime. And most of us think that's the be-all and end-all. The vast majority of people, that's what they believe. And they consequently mistake the temporary dharma for eternal dharma. So, any questions about that?
Sometimes people turn to love and the only thing separate them is death. They still in the love. Like my granny, actually my grandfather is not anymore, but she still remember him all the time.
Yeah.
It's just like she feel like she's connected. In India we have tradition, we remember our, like, you know, just this is called, you know, Shraddha, Pitra Dosha, something. So we actually remember every year there's a week before we do fasting. And just we have
yeah, it's an ancestor type of worship.
Yeah, and we do. Mine was actually today. So I went to Hare Krishna temple, gave them, you know, all the like fruit and we do rice and whatever, like a few other things and give some donation. But then just they say, okay, we remember our ancestors, they thank you very much and they can forgive us for any
yeah, the belief there is that the duty is to offer this Shraddha ceremony yearly so that the souls of the departed will be looked after. And if in that belief that if you don't do that, then your ancestors, parents, whomever has left the planet would be floating in limbo, and the welfare of their souls wouldn't be looked after unless that's done.
But saying we're responsible for their happiness.
Well, that's the Hindu belief. I'm not advocating that.
What if they had reincarnated in the meantime?
Well, that's it. They're going to reincarnate at some point. But you know, you can do that, and that's fine. But if you have a connection to God, and you worship God, you meditate on God, then you're watering the root of the tree. When you water the root of the tree, all the branches are benefited. So you don't have to do specific things for specific groups if you're going right to the source. And the more you elevate yourself in spiritual consciousness, the more everybody benefits. If you become a liberated soul at the end of this lifetime, which means you've cleared all your karma, you have no karma, you don't have to come back to suffer any karma, you don't have to come back to enjoy any karma in the material sphere. You've cleared it all. You have no more material desires related to the body, related to the material experience. You've purged yourself of all of that, or cleansed yourself. So you're acting like a soul, like a spiritual being, like the spiritual being you are. Then you'll become liberated. It's called moksha. And you don't have to take another birth in the material world, which means you're not subject to death, suffering, etc. If you can attain that state, seven generations of your family behind you and in front of you, in the past generations and future generations, will be freed of all sinful reaction. All sinful reaction, all negative karmic reaction. They'll have a clean slate. That they won't become liberated, but all of that negative reaction will be cleared off simply by you becoming a God conscious soul and a liberated soul. Pardon? You're taking one for the team. Exactly true. That's how it works. So, not easy to come to that stage. And then beyond getting liberated is developing love for God. And that's a much higher stage than just liberation. Most people who understand liberation from a Eastern philosophical perspective believe that they lose their individuality and their identity, and they merge into the energy of God, or they become God, they become the Godhead, they become that divine energy. And that is legitimately God realization, but it's the first level of God realization. It's the energetic level. God can be realized in three forms. Now, if you were raised in the Catholic Church, right, like most of you were, what did you do all the time in your childhood? You crossed yourself in the name of the Son, Holy Spirit. Here's God realized in three forms. So the Holy Spirit is the energetic form of the Godhead. Is God in his energy, for example. The sun is a ball of fire. You can see it in the sky. You can't look at it for very long. But there it is. The sun's energy is the sunlight or sunbeams. So that would be the same as God's energy or Brahman, Brahmajyoti, the divine energy that sustains the whole creation. So you can merge into the energy of God. That's the first level of God realization. The second level of God realization is in the name of the Father, the Son. What does the Son mean? S-O-N. That means diversity. It's not one Son. It's all the sons and all the daughters and all the manifestations. Everybody has God within them, including all the animals. You can realize God in diversity. That's what the sun level means. That God is in every single being. That's a higher state of realization. You can see God in everything and in everyone. And that's what the yogis do. So that's the second level. The third level of God realization, the highest level, is Bhagawan, Father. And that is God in personality. Energy, diversity, personality. You meet the guy behind it all. Right? You can walk into, a wonderful factory that makes
chocolate.
You can go to Mr. Cadbury's factory where they make these wonderful Cadbury chocolate bars. How we do? Okay? You go in there, but nobody's there. Nobody's there. But there's all of the machines. There's all of the cocoa that they use and the chocolate and the this and the that, and it's all there. Now you're in the energy of the Cadbury experience. Then the door opens and in walk all of the employees who run the factory and make the chocolate. Now you're into the diversity of the Cadbury experience, because all of them get a paycheck with Cadbury written on it. Or maybe they have a nice apron that says Cadbury. So here is the Cadbury experience in diversity. They're all connected in this place. You can have a relationship with them. They'll tell you how they get the caramel inside the chocolate, which is no mean feat. Or then, if you're really lucky, you can go up to the executive offices on the top floor, northeast of the building, and there, through the double doors, is behind the big desk is Mr. Cadbury himself. The brains behind the whole operation. and you meet him. Now, he's not made of chocolate. And you meet him and talk to him, and he tells you how he came up with this wonderful idea, and you tell him how fantastic you think his creations are. And your favorite, of course, Turkish Delight. Or whatever it might be. You know? Fruit and nut. So, this is an example of how it works. It works like this. So, if you just want to be standing in the building by yourself with nobody there and lose your identity, so this loss of identity and individuality is connected to what is called the Mayavad or impersonalist philosophy, which states the following. And this is very common in India. The material world is a place of suffering and death. So that means that all of this diversity and individuality and all these people and animals, etc., this diversity must be connected to suffering and death. So therefore, anything that has eternal life and joy and happiness and fulfillment must be exactly the opposite. It must not have any diversity. It must not have any individuality. It just must be a homogeneous, energetic void. That's how they arrive at that. And can you experience on that level?
Sure.
That's not very exciting. It's more exciting when you actually meet the people who are making the chocolate, and then all the way up to Mr. Cadbury, God himself. Another thing that I was going to mention that this Bhaktivinoda had said, here in the material world, we take this world to be the be-all and end-all, and we invest all our time and energy in making ourselves comfortable here. Our goal is not to be here. Our goal is to go back to the spiritual world, to live with God, to be spiritual beings, fully conscious, to live eternally in full knowledge and complete, unadulterated happiness, bliss. That's the goal. In loving relationship with God. Right? Material world is like stopping at an inn, a hotel, for the night. You stopped off, and you're going to spend a night or two on your way to your destination, the spiritual realm. Can you imagine? Here you are at the inn, and now you're redecorating, you're calling in the painters, right? And you're ordering stuff from eBay, online, and you're... Hey, it's a stop-off place. This is not your destination. But that's how we treat it, because we forget that we're on our way to someplace. This is not the goal. Anyway, I thought that was a great analogy he gave. All right. Questions? Comments? No, but I think Kalindi has made some scones. Did you offer the scones?
I have something like a milk chocolate.
You do that?
You know the pera they made?
The which? Pera?
Yeah.
Oh, you have pera? Oh, very good. And we have some fresh fruit too. We've sliced up for you. when you offer, when you prepare your food, if you offer it to God before you eat it, which is essentially like saying grace, then any karmic reaction from eating that food is nullified. There is no karmic reaction. So this is something you do, you know, 2-3 times a day, depending how often you like to eat. So highly recommend that you offer your food, because that spiritualizes it. Just a simple prayer will do it.
You know when I eat your food?
The Japanese guy called.
Matsumoto, is that the guy with the water?
Hidden
messages in water. Yeah, praying over your food. Because in food also, as you know, I'm sure, takes on the vibration of whoever it is that prepares it. So if you walk into a restaurant and you look at the cook behind the, you know, the counter in the kitchen, if he doesn't look like he's in a good frame of mind, then you cook. What we do is we cook for God. We cook for Krishna. We cook for his satisfaction, not for ours. And then you offer it to God, and then you take the remnants of the food. Now, all the food's there, but, you know, energetically he's eaten the food or accepted the offering. And then you take the remnants. And then you're eating spiritual food.
Good for the digestive system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's so angry. You know, I don't know why anybody would be in the kitchen yelling and screaming and everybody. But I have a story. Yeah. I was staying at my friend's house in Seattle years ago, just for a couple days, a few days. And his girlfriend lived with him. She was a very nice girl. I got along great with her. She was actually a fabulous cook. And one morning, we came down to the kitchen, and she was just ready to go out the door. And he says, "Gee, honey, can you rustle up some breakfast for us?" And she's on her way to the gym. She's jacket's on. She's got her gym bag. She's almost out the door. She says, "Well, I was going to the gym." He says, "Yeah, well, come on. You know, we got a guest. You want to make us a little breakfast, don't you?" Well, she clearly did not want to make any breakfast for anybody. She threw the bag down, took her jacket off, threw that, and cooked this wonderful breakfast. And I, you know, I was going, "Oh, no, you don't have to do..." She says, yes, she does. Come on, honey. Like this, you know. So she did. And it was great breakfast. Multi-course breakfast. And as soon as she finished cooking it, she was gone. I ate the breakfast. He ate the breakfast. I had heartburn and indigestion all day long. It wouldn't go away. I couldn't not have eaten it after all that. You know, oh, gee, not hungry. So.
Next time you say we're going out for breakfast.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Oh. All right, wait till you
get back. Okay. Okay, so let's do the mantra. Has everybody got this page? This is a mantra to Radha. Radha, the divine feminine. As we've talked about many, many times, God is not realized in Eastern understanding as a man. only. There's the energetic and the energy. So God is male in that sense, but the energy, his energy is feminine, always feminine. So what's more important? Well, you can't have one without the other. They're both important. You don't minimize the influence of the divine feminine. The divine masculine never shows up without the divine feminine, and vice versa. And you see this nicely portrayed in Vedic understanding in the form of Radha and Krishna, who are in the middle there on the altar. And then Lakshmi Narayan. Narayan is another name for Vishnu on the far right side. Lakshmi is the goddess of fortune. And Vishnu is God, as Krishna is God. And that is also another porcelain of Lakshmi on the left, goddess of fortune. Or Shiva and Parvati. It's always male and female. So here is a mantra, a very simple mantra for the divine feminine. The benefits of chanting this mantra. Radha represents the divine feminine in her form as pure love for God. Also included within her purview are transcendental love, unconditional love, compassion, empathy, kindness, generosity, sacrifice performed out of love, as well as positive change and transformation inspired by love. She represents the highest manifestation of loving exchange with God, the lover and the beloved. That is possible for both a conditioned soul or a liberated soul. What are we? We're conditioned souls at this stage, hoping to become liberated souls. If you are looking for a human relationship with a high soul who will bring spiritual expansion to your life, then this is the mantra to chant. If you want to increase your love for God or all living beings or both, then this is the mantra to chant. If you are looking for true love in any or all its forms, then invoke Radha's blessing with this mantra. This mantra awards all good qualities to those who chant it. So the mantra, you see it there in the transliteration, and then you see how to pronounce it in the parentheses. So let me say it a few times. Shrim Radhayai Swaha. 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 Keep going. Swahayai.
Shri Radhayai Swaha. Shri Radhayai Swaha. Shri Radhayai Swaha.
Okay. Good. So I invite you to practice with this mantra. In fact, let's do a meditation and use the mantra during the meditation and see what appears, see what happens. Close your eyes. Breathe. Relax and let go. Deeply, deeply relax and let go. Allow the stress, the tension, the fear, the apprehension to drain from your body. Totally, completely relax, breathe, and let go. Deeply, deeply relax. High above, envision a beautiful beam of radiant pearl white light coming down, down, all the way down. Entering through the top of your head, expanding throughout your head, torso, arms, legs, out the bottom of your feet, into the earth below. Breathe. Relax. Let go. See and feel yourself by means of this divine light connected to the heavens above and grounded in the earth below. Breathe and let go. All right. I want you to allow, we're going to start, you just quietly, silently chant the mantra. Shrim Radhayai Swaha. Shrim Radhayai Swaha. And let a scene open in front of you. Let the mind show you what it wants to show you. The mind's eye. Allow it to open. Shrim Radhayai Swaha. Where are you? What do you see? Where do you see yourself? Are you indoors? Are you outdoors? Where are you? Shrim Radhayai Swaha. Who appears? Who do you see? How do they approach you? What is their attitude, disposition? How do they react upon seeing you? Shreem Radhayai Swaha. What do they say to you? What do they suggest? What do they offer you? Do they have something to give? Or do they want something from you? Shreem Radhayai Swaha. What happens between you? And what is the conclusion? How does it all resolve? How does it end? Shreem Radhayai Swaha. Continue in your meditation with these steps until you are complete. When you're complete, return to consciousness, awakening, feeling refreshed, relaxed, and at peace.